Welcome to the A Sound Effect Podcast, the podcast about sound effects. My name is Asbjørn Andersen, and I'm the founder of asoundeffect.com.
And I'm Christian Halskjær, founder of Hertz & Bits Sound Effects.
What's in store for this one?
It's a big issue today. I'd like to talk about soul.
Oh.
yes. Not your soul, not my soul.
Oh, okay.
But, you know, the relatively recent Pixar animated feature, Soul.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, it's a little bit different from many of the other Pixar films. It's like many of the approaches they used to have, like a lot of interesting or wild animated effects and sort of all that stuff. It's like they toned it down a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if it's because of the intended audience for the film that maybe it's for slightly older people, not older people, but you know, grown-ups, maybe not kids as much. So it's like they have let the story drive the whole thing a bit more than wild visuals or whatever. So as you can probably guess, the interview for this episode is about the film Soul.
Oh.
Yes. That's what I'm getting at. Yeah. So Jennifer Walden spoke to supervising sound editor Koya Elliott from Skywalker Sound,
mm-hmm.
and re-recording mixer, sound designer and supervising sound editor Ren Kleiss,
mm-hmm.
about their work on Soul.
Okay.
So that should be good.
Absolutely. I look forward to hearing it. But before we get to that, let's hear some of the interesting new releases from the sound effects community.
Dune Drones by High Lonesome Sound is an extremely rare recording of singing sand dunes, recorded in Death Valley National Park and captured with contact mics, hydrophones, and very low noise condenser mics. Mutate Organic by Boom Library is, and I quote, a deliciously abnormal collection of mutating and morphing life forms and rogue organic matter. You get both a designed collection and a full construction kit. Tropical Caves by Binaural Recordings is cave recordings from Colombia, Thailand, Malaysia, and Laos, delivered in stereo, binaural, and ambisonic formats for immersive audio productions. Western Black Powder Guns by Barney Oram is a collection of 19th century firearm sounds from classic Wild West style weapons, including revolvers, rifles, and carbines. You get multi-mic coverage and various recording distances. Next up is an interview with Koya Elliott and Ren Kleiss about their sound work on Soul.
Hey, this is Jennifer Walden for Sound Effect. I'm here with supervising sound editors Koya Elliott and Ren Kleiss to talk about their work on Pixar's latest film, Soul, available to stream on Disney+. Soul follows the story of middle school music teacher and jazz musician Joe Gardner. Joe scores the gig of a lifetime, but before the big performance, he falls down an open manhole and goes into a coma while his soul travels to the great beyond. But instead of willingly going towards the light at the end of the tunnel, Joe tears a hole in the fabric of space-time, I think, and jumps through. He's transported to the great before, or rather the U Seminar, as it's rebranded. This is where new souls receive their personalities and interests and find their spark before making their way down to Earth. There, Joe gets paired up with 22, a soul who has no interest in having a life. Joe tries to help 22 find a spark of their own, and in doing so, discovers deeper meaning to his own life. It's a wonderfully weighty and philosophical story that's presented with whimsy and humor and heart in that uniquely Pixar way. So looking at the sound side of things, who was your point person on this film? Was it directors Pete Docter and Kemp Powers?
Actually, we were in communication with the whole team. Ren spent time at Pixar working with Kevin Nolting, the picture editor, and Pete Docter and Kemp and producer Dana Murray. It's a very collaborative team. Those are only a few of the names, but those were definitely the point people.
We were in contact with all the people that Koya mentioned, for sure, and our post-producer, Jesse. And in terms of creative collaboration, certainly there was the day-to-day with Kevin, picture editor. And then, of course, we would do check-ins with Pete and the team. The initial meetings were with Pete early on, about 2 years ago. His first big concern was, what does the great beyond sound like? And he wanted the sound of the great beyond to feel different than planet Earth and New York. And he wanted there to be a sense of awe and a mild sense of foreboding, but he didn't want it to also be scary. And then to make it even more complicated, then at the end of the film, he wanted that same sound to feel warm and inviting when Joe ultimately relinquishes and lets go and is ready to go into the great beyond. Pete wanted that sound to be the same as the beginning, yet somehow in the beginning, it feels scary or ominous, and at the ending, it feels warm and inviting. So that was the first thing he set us on to create sonically for him.
And Koya, what was one of the first things you worked on when you joined the film?
The first thing that I did was we started with our Foley department. We had our Foley editor, Tom Brennan, come on and spot, and our second editor, Dee Selby. So we worked with the Foley department to make sure that they were up and running. Then the reel that I cut was the end sequence, reel 5, right after Joe falls back into the U seminar, the great before. And I just kind of worked my way through that reel, which was a little bit of the great before and then the club. And then when we're chasing after 22, when we realize that she's a lost soul. And that sequence was really fun.
This is such a music-driven film. You have the original compositions from jazz musician John Batiste, as well as the score from composers Atticus Ross and Trent Reznor for those more philosophical areas in the film, like the U Seminar and The Great Beyond. So how did the music impact your approach to the sound design?
The music was the number one most important thing to Pete, starting in the early days, 2 years ago, 2+. It's close to really actually 3 years when I'm thinking about it, because that's when he first started to think about the soundtrack. He has these wonderful composers that he works with, Michael Giacchino being his main composer that he loves to collaborate with. And Michael had done the last film prior to this, Inside Out. So we all just assumed that Pete would want to work with Michael again, and he did. But then he started thinking about the music and how it would relate to the jazz music that John Batiste was going to be composing. Pete was interested in exploring the idea of Atticus and Trent as composers. What was interesting about Pete's decision to go with Trent and Atticus was that they come from such a different place musically that has darker sounds. And getting a team together or get creative people to task them with things that maybe they're not so comfortable with, I think was a great creative idea. And I think that it also showed a wonderful contrast, the music that Trent and Atticus did versus John's music. They really worked beautifully together, but they also completely were in contrast to one another. One of the very first pieces of music that came up on the list of important cues was the one at the very ending, this piece of music called Epiphany. And Epiphany is the piece of music where after Joe gets his life back and he has his wonderful performance with Dorothea and he's euphoric, but he realizes that something's missing. He thought that the answer to life would be that he would get this gig and he would be fulfilled. But instead, he realized that getting the gig of his lifetime had nothing to do with being happy. And he has this epiphany as he sees the world through his own eyes while 22 was in his body. It's a wonderful concept because he starts having these memories that are not his memories. They're her memories. And that piece of music was very important to Pete, that it started off being John Batiste playing, but then it would slowly become a piece of music that Trenton Atticus would compose, that then would slowly go back to a piece of music that John Batiste would perform and compose. So that was a very tricky piece, and that one took a long time for everyone to figure out how to make that work. That, of course, coupled with all the imagery and the picture editing and all the decisions of that sequence to make it an interior monologue and make it mostly music. In fact, there was a moment where we played that scene completely, just music, but then Pete started to realize, you know, the last film I did that same thing and was Up, at the very beginning of Up, and Michael Giacchino had written this beautiful piece of music. And in the end, the team that worked on that film had this beautiful sound design for all the sequences, but then in the end, they went with music, and it was very, very powerful. Pete wanted to have the same kind of emotional feeling that was similar to Up in this epiphany sequence in Soul, but he didn't want it to be exactly the same. And so we ended up adding very few sounds to the flashback memories of Joe's life as he was growing up and seeing his mother and being a baby and looking up into his mother's eyes as she bathes him in the bathtub and being with his father and riding his bicycle. And that intercut with the memories of 22, which even though Joe's body is an adult, he's seeing what she saw somewhat like a child, seeing the people on the street eating the pizza for the first time, how wonderful it tasted, smelling the air for the first time, seeing the seed fall down from the tree and catching it in her hand, which was his hand. All of these things are very high concept ideas that Pete and Kemp we're trying to give the audience without it being too heavy-handed. So to wrap all the way back to your question about music, music was definitely there all the time and always dovetailing in between sound and jazz and score. And that took us a while to figure out.
So there are some sounds in this that are musical. For instance, when Terry goes to the earthly plane and she's trying to track down 22 and Joe, that sound that she has is tonal. So when you were creating that sound, were you concerned that it might contrast with the music or rub in any way?
Yes, we were constantly worried about harmonic dissonance between the musical sounds of the sound effects versus the music score or the jazz music. So we were always paying attention to those tones. For example, in The Great Before, we had made the sound effects in a similar key to the music that we had at the time, which was not Trenton Atticus, it was a temp track. And then when Trenton Atticus wrote their piece, it was in a different key. And so we had to actually make adjustments to the key of certain scenes to fit the new music that they were doing that was coming in. So yes, with Terry and with other numerous areas that had tonal sounds, we were always listening to make sure we weren't clashing harmonically.
And was this something that the composers would point out to? Like if something sounded okay to you, but maybe rubbed them the wrong way, would they suggest that you like pitch that up a little or pitch it down?
I'm sure they would have if they were there with us, but sadly we hit the mix of this film during the COVID lockdown. And so we weren't able to have anyone come visit us and be with us in what would be normally a proper mix collaborative experience. So I'm sure if they were there, and maybe they still have notes that we never heard of, but we tried as best as we could to send them our mixes as we were working on them and get feedback. And Pete, you know, Pete is a musician as well as Kemp. Both of them are very musical and have a very sharp musical ear. And Pete would often catch harmonic rubs. You know, he'd go, that sound seems a little low or that seems a little high. You know, Pete would often flag certain things. But we tried to get it done ourselves as best as we could. And then what was great about with working with Trenton Atticus is we had a lot of their music for a long time. So we could build our sound around their music.
Let's talk about the sound of the unborn souls. It was so adorable. But as they say in the biz, it's always challenging to work with kids and animals. So was it challenging to get all of those kid vocals and laughs without getting actual words from them?
Our dialogue editor, Cheryl Nardi, she ran the loop group sessions. She herself is great with kids, and she just had such a great time working with the kids. There was that worry, like, how do we get the kids to speak in gibberish, but without making it sound like gibberish? You know, some of the English lines were actually recorded when she went up for Toy Story 4. It was done in Vancouver. So they had that to work with. And then all the gibberish and the vocalizations were done in 2020, right before the lockdown happened. Everyone was really happy with all the vocals that they did. just adorable. She has so many great stories about coaxing the kids and then how they relax in front of the mic. And some of the younger ones just did like a fabulous job.
Oh man, I'm so glad it happened before the lockdown, because that would have really complicated the whole issue, like having to record these kids' vocals remotely.
Yeah, I mean, just being in person makes things so much easier. I know crews now are able to do loop group remotely, but it's definitely a different style, different way of working, especially with children too.
Cheryl's very skilled at coaxing and getting great performances out of people, particularly children, but she's just so much fun to be around. Jesse Schroeder and Jeremy Sloan, who are from Pixar, who were wrangling all the logistics of how we were going to record the loop group. Jeremy just loves Cheryl. You know, they're like BFFs, best friends forever, you know, and it's because Cheryl is so much fun and she can just make everybody in the room feel so comfortable, happy, and she's very charming. So it's no doubt that that's why the sounds, the performances of these kids are so good, because she coaxed these performances out of them. And she's got this great way of going, come on, you can do it. She has this huge smile and she can just pull the stuff out of people that is really a skill.
She's very playful.
Yeah, playful.
Yeah, she's like kid at heart.
So the light at the end of the tunnel, as it were, in the great beyond, is that a bug zapper?
I'm glad that you think it's a bug zapper, because it is a bug zapper. And that was the second sound that Pete asked for nearly 3 years ago. Your soul goes into the great beyond and goes, zap. What is that sound? We explored all sorts of different sounds. And it's such a huge, big ball of white light. And it's such a dramatic concept that you are dying, right? So yeah. The initial sounds were very, you know, we had some reversed thunder that would make these big sounds and very intense. Pete listened through a bunch of different options and he was concerned that it would be too much for young viewers. And also he wanted to have a sense of playfulness and humor. And it was actually his idea. He thought, well, what if we just have this sound that's intense, 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 and all of a sudden it goes, bzz. And it's almost anticlimactic. And because of it being anticlimactic, there's a small sense of relief and even humor and comedy that we maybe laugh at it, or at least not be afraid of it. So yes, bug zapper.
It's hilarious and yeah. A perfect choice.
Yeah.
So let's talk about the lost souls. There's this one scene where you hear this muffled, droning voice repeating something. And then it's revealed that the guy's actually saying, make a trade, after they've reawakened a soul. What was your processing on that lost soul's vocal sound?
The sound of the make a trade was, Kevin had a temp version of that in his Avid that gave the idea. And oftentimes when we're working with Kevin and Pete, there'll be some sort of rough idea of what it's supposed to be. Like, here's just a quick idea. We want it to be more nuanced than that, but here it is. The task was to have it sound human, have it sound a little strange and unintelligible and constantly repeating. Then it would slowly be revealed or morph into make a trade. We have these plugins that we use, and there's this one wonderful program made by Earcom. What it allows you to do is take any dialogue line and put it in, and you can really bend not just pitch, but format structure, almost nasal length. You can bend and change certain parameters of a vocal without changing other parameters. And by finding these weird moments to pitch some things down and making it nasal and making it glottal and so forth, we came up with this sound, and it was a combination of this program and another program that made this vocal sound. And in the end, we crossfaded that to just the natural actor's voice going, make a trade, make a trade, make a trade. And Pete loved it and he was very happy. And that was presented early on because that was one of the important sounds that we wanted to make sure we had right at the beginning. But then when we keep working on the scene, he kind of went, hey, you know I proved that, but it just sort of sounds like you're crossfading from one sound to the next. Is there any way that you can actually make the muffled sound change in itself to go to the natural sound? And that was a little tricky transition. So right at that transition, we take this Earcom process vocal and then we start pitching it up half step higher, half step higher, half step higher, half step higher, and then slowly manipulated those half step higher vocals getting less affected until it then crossfaded into the natural voice. So the effect is make a trade, make a trade. And then at the very ending, we have a different performance of the actor where he has a realization. He goes, make a trade. Is that what my life is all about? So at the very ending, there's an actual change in his read. that Kevin had cut in his Avid early on, and we kept that. So yeah, a lot of little tricky moments. We're really glad that you picked that one up as something to talk about for sure. And then later on, of course, that recapitulates into the different scenes where we see, gotta find it, gotta find it, gotta find it, and all the other voices that happen through there. One of the nice things, lastly, about being in this modern age is that because we created this preset using this program, we could then share the settings that we came up with our foreign team, so that when the language gets dubbed into German or Spanish and all the other languages, that same sound can be applied to every language. And then we gave very specific instructions on how we did the transition and so forth. So I just recently watched the Spanish version of the film, and I've been really enjoying hearing that even in different languages, the team in London did a very nice job of doing exactly what was done in the English version.
That London team you mentioned was led by Jens Christensen at Pinewood Studios. It's so great that we're talking about their work because the international market is huge. And, you know, giving that same film experience to non-English speaking audiences, I mean, it's just awesome for them and for you guys too.
Normally one of us goes every year to help when they have questions. And we went a few years ago on The Incredibles, and it's great to meet him and his team. And it's how they work together, by the way. They have a database and each team is in a different room and they're all sharing a common Pro Tools session. And as things get tweaked, they all inform each other on a checklist. It's an incredibly complicated process that they do, and they don't get enough credit for it. And I'm really glad that we're talking about them. It's a huge part of the market, and it's important for the film and how the film is perceived in different countries and different languages and enjoyed.
Yeah, I wanted to give a shout out to them too, because towards the end of the final mix, we start to field lots of questions from them, and they're very conscientious about wanting to do it exactly how we've done it, and what did we do for this, and what did we do for that. So it's another great collaboration.
Yeah, I love that there's been this evolution from crappy overdubs into this process of globalization. Like, I love that this transition has happened.
Totally. The fact that you love it makes me super happy. And it's not just this, it's reverb, you know, it's like the sound of the dialogue, for example, of the mentors. David Parker and Nathan Nance actually helped with the premix of those sounds. Early on, Pete wanted the sound of the counselors to sound a little bit different than Joe's voice, but he didn't want them to sound pitched down like the way that the Lost Soul sounded, but he wanted them to sound different. We came up with a technique of spreading their dialogue, not just in the center where we normally put it, but a little bit on the left, a little bit on the right, and then adding reverb and delays and these very specific articulations of their voices to kind of give them a little bit bigger than life sound without making them sound like monsters. And getting back to the foreign dub, all of those presets and how much divergence on the panning of the dialogue and so forth, and the actual presets of the reverbs even, we could share with the foreign team and they could replicate that sound for those dialogue bits as well. We're in that new territory where we can really collaborate and share what we've done.
So because this is an enlightening film that makes you think about life in a whole new way, I wanted to take a philosophical turn for my last question. What was one challenge or opportunity in Seoul that helped you to grow as a sound artist or made you think about sound in a new way?
I mean, I guess my first response would be, it teaches you to be patient. We have a great library, and say we even go and record something and you think, okay, great, I'm going to use these sounds for this scene. And then it's going to be great. And then you go and you start to cut the sounds and then you realize like, oh, that doesn't work at all. Okay, let's step back. Let's talk to Ren. Let's play it for somebody else. Let's use another sound. It's kind of working with layers and then stepping back and being patient. And also for me, honestly, a big one is, how do you receive it when it isn't liked? What do you do with that information? And you think of it as like, oh, okay, we're all on the team together. It's not like one individual making a mistake. It's this whole collaboration, if that makes sense.
To Koya's point, there are moments where everybody's contribution and what every single person on our team brings to their work, it's very personal. There's a meaning to it. And sometimes, for whatever reason, we can't have all of those sounds play. And so there's that moment where someone's hard work isn't audible and it hurts. You feel like, oh, why did I work so hard on that? when it ended up being abandoned. And the big takeaway for me is that that's okay. The contribution of each individual, in a way, sometimes those things can work together. And oftentimes, however, the filmmaker just wants to have the audience focus on something that's different than that. And it's okay. We can still feel good about our work, no matter what ends up happening and when ends up in the final mix.
Awesome. Well, Ren, Koya, thank you guys so much for taking some time out to talk about Soul with me.
You're welcome. All right. Thank you.
Bye.
If you want more podcasts about sound, check out these messages from our friends in the audio podcasting community. You can find them all at audiopodcast.org.
Immersive Audio Podcast, a podcast that explores all things immersive audio. We talk to thought leaders covering the art, science, and business of this fast-changing industry. We aim to inform, educate, explore, and unite the community. Subscribe now on your favorite podcast app.
Hi, all. This is Becky and Susan from the Sound Girls podcast, where we speak to audio professionals from all walks of life. Join us Tuesdays at 9 a.m. and listen to the amazing array of sound humans talk about how they got into the biz. And a few cool things, like roadie nicknames and fizzy water preferences.
You can find the Sound Girls podcast wherever you listen to podcasts, as well as our website, soundgirls.org.
Hi, this is Michael Helms, host of the Location Sound podcast. My recent guest is production sound mixer Jimmy Seiska, based out of Los Angeles, California. We talk about recording sound on the Bravo series Below Deck Mediterranean and the Amazon series The Pack, hosted by Lindsey Vonn. Check out the latest episode.
Hey, everybody. This is Tim from Tone Benders. In our latest episode, we talk with four-time Oscar winner Richard King. He tells us about the ultra-complicated sound for Christopher Nolan's latest film, Tenet. We talk about creating interesting sound design for scenes happening in reverse, how to build cinematic body punches, and his thoughts on the controversy over the film's dialogue mix. Listen wherever you find podcasts or at tonebenderspodcast.com.
That's it for this episode. A big thanks to Jennifer Walden for interviewing and to Koya Elliott and Ren Kleiss for being on the show. Be sure to subscribe to the SoundEffect podcast at asoundeffect.com/podcast. Thanks a lot for listening and see you next time. Take care.